Vimes turned the clove over and over under the magnifying glass. "I see tooth marks," he said.
"Yes, sir,"
said Littlebottom, who represented in her entirety the watch's forensic department.
"Looks like someone was chewing it like a toothpick."
Vimes sat back. "I would say," he said, "that this was last touched by a swarthy man of about my height. He had several gold teeth and a beard, and a slight cast in one eye, scarred. He was carrying a large weapon, curved, I'd say, and you'd have to call what he was wearing a turban because it wasn't moving fast enough to be a badger." Littlebottom looked astonished. "Detectoring is like gambling," said Vimes, putting down the clove. "The secret is to know the winner in advance. Thank you, Corporal. Write down that description and make sure everyone gets a copy, please. He goes by the name of 71-Hour Ahmed. Heaven knows why. And then go and get some rest." Vimes turned to face Carrot and Angua, who had crammed into the tiny little room, and nodded at the girl.
"I followed the clove smell all the way down to the docks," she said.
"And then?"
"Then I lost it."
Angua looked embarrassed.
"I didn't have any trouble through the fish market, sir, or in the slaughterhouse district. And then it went into the spice market."
"Ah, I see. And didn't come out again?"
"In a way, sir. Or came out going 50 different ways. Sorry."
"Can't be helped. Carrot?"
"I did what you said, sir. The top of the opera house is about the right distance from our archery butts. I used a bow just like the one he used, sir."
Vimes raised a finger. Carrot stared and then slowly said, "Like the one you found next to him?"
"Right.
And?"
"It's a burly and strong in the arm, sure shot five, sir. A bow for the expert. I'm not a great bowman, but I could at least hit the target at that elevation, but..."
"I'm ahead of you," said Vimes. "You're a big lad, Carrot. Our late Ossie had arms like Nobby. I could put my hand round them."
"Yes, sir. It's a 100-pound draw. I doubt if he could even pull the string back."
"I'd hate to watch him try. Good grief, the only thing he could be sure of hitting with a bow like that would be his foot. By the way, do you think anyone saw you up there?"
"I doubt it, sir. I was right in among the chimneys and the air vents."
Vimes sighed. "Captain, I expect if you'd done it in a cellar at midnight, his lordship would have said, 'Wasn't it rather dark down there?' next morning." He took out the by now rather creased picture. There was Carrot, or at least Carrot's arm and ear, as he ran towards the procession. And there, among the people in the procession, turning to look at him, was the face of the prince. There was no sign of 71-Hour Ahmed. He'd been at the soiree, hadn't he? But then there'd been all that milling around at the door, people changing places, treading on one another's robes, nipping back to the privy, walking into one another. He could have gone anywhere. And the prince fell as you got to him, with the arrow in his back. He was still facing you.
"Yes, sir, I'm sure of that. Everyone else was milling around, of course."
"So he was shot in the back by a man in front of him who could not possibly have used the bow that he didn't shoot him with from the wrong direction." There was a tapping at the window. "That'll be down, Spout," said Vimes without looking round. "I sent him on an errand." Downspout never quite fitted in. It wasn't that he didn't get on with people, because he hardly ever met people, except those whose activities took them above, say, second floor level. Constable Downspout's beat was the rooftops. Very slowly. He'd come down for the watch's hog's watch party and had poured gravy into his ears to show willing, but gargoyles got very nervy indoors at ground level, and he had soon exited via the chimney, and his paper squeaker had echoed out forlornly amongst the snowy rooftops all night. But gargoyles were good at watching, and good at remembering, and very, very good at being patient. Vimes opened the window. Moving jerkily, Downspout unfolded himself into the room, and then quickly scrambled up onto a corner of Vimes's desk for the comfort that it brought. Angua and Carrot stared at the arrow the gargoyle held in his hand.
"Ah, well done," said Vimes, in the same even voice. "Where did you find it, Downspout?"
Downspout spluttered a series of guttural syllables only pronounceable by someone with a mouth shaped like a pipe. "In the wall on the second floor of the dress shop in the Plaza of Broken Moons," Carrot translated.
"Isk,"
said Downspout. "That's barely halfway to Sartor Square, sir."
"Yes," said Vimes. "A small, weak man trying to pull a heavy bow. The arrow wobbling all over the place. Thank you very much, Downspout. There will be an extra pigeon for you this week."
said Downspout, and clambered back out of the window.
"Excuse me, sir,"
said Angua. She took the arrow from Vimes, and closing her eyes, sniffed at it gingerly.
"Oh, yes, Ossie," she said, "all over it."
"Thank you, Corporal. It's as well to be sure."
Carrot took the arrow from the werewolf and looked at it critically. "Huh, peacock feathers and a plated point. It's the sort of thing an amateur buys because he thinks it'll magically improve his shot. Showy."
"Right," said Vimes. "You, Carrot, and you, Angua, you're on the case."
"Sir, I don't understand," said Carrot. "I am perplexed. I thought you said Fred and Nobby were investigating this."
"Yes," said Vimes.
"But Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobbs are investigating why the late Ossie tried to kill the prince. And you know what? They're going to find lots of clues. I just know it. I can feel it in my water."
"But we know he couldn't have," said Carrot.
"Isn't this fun?" said Vimes. "I don't want you to get in Fred's way. Just, ask around. Try Dunnett Duncan or Sidney Lopsides. There's a man with his ear to the ground, all right. Or the Agony Aunts, or Lily Goodtime, or Mr. Slider. Haven't seen him around for a while, but..."
"He's dead, sir."
"What? Smelly Slider? When?"
"Last month, sir. He got hit by a falling bedstead. Freak accident, sir."
"No one told me."
"You were busy, sir. But you put some money in the envelope when Fred brought it round, sir. $10, which Fred remarked was very generous."
Vimes sighed. "Oh, yes, the envelopes. Fred was always wandering around with an envelope these days. Someone was always leaving, or some friend of the watch was in trouble, or there was a raffle, or the tea money was low again, or some complicated explanation, so Vimes just put some money in. Simplest way. Old Smelly Slider."
"You should have mentioned it," he said reproachfully.
"You've been working hard, sir."
"Any other street news you haven't mentioned, Captain?"
"Not that I can think of, sir."
"All right. Well, see which way the wind is blowing, very carefully, and trust no one."
Carrot looked worried.
"I can trust Angua, can't I?" he said.
"Well, of course you...
And you, presumably.
Me? Well, obviously, that goes without saying.
Corporal Littlebottom, she can be very helpful.
Cheery, yes, certainly you can trust Cheery.
Sergeant Detritus, I always thought he was very...
Detritus, oh yes, he...
Nobby, should I..."
"Carrot, I understand what he means,"
said Angua, tugging his arm. Carrot looked a little crestfallen.
"I've never liked, you know, underhand things," he mumbled.
"I don't want any written reports," said Vimes, grateful for that small mercy. "This is unofficial, but officially unofficial, if you see what I mean."
Angua nodded. Carrot just stayed looking dismal.
"She's a werewolf," thought Vimes. "Of course she understands. And you think a man who is technically a dwarf would be able to fold his head around the idea of subterfuge."
"Look, just listen to the streets," said Vimes. "The streets know everything. Talk to Blind Hugh."
"I'm afraid he passed away last month," said Carrot.
"Did he? No one told me."
"I thought I sent you a memo, sir."
Vimes glanced guiltily at his overloaded desk and then shrugged.
"Have a quiet look at things, get to the bottom of things, and trust practically no one, all right, except trustworthy people. Come on, open up, watch business."
Corporal Nobbs pulled at Sergeant Colon's sleeve and whispered in his ear.
Not watch business," said Colon, pounding the door again. "Nothing to do with the watch at all. We're all just, civilians, all right?"
The door opened a crack.
"Yes?"
said a voice that counted its small change.
"We have to ask some questions, missus."
"Are you the watch?" said the voice.
"No! I think I just made that clear."
"Piss off, copper."
The door slammed.
"You sure this is the right place, Sarge? Harry Chestnut said he saw Ossie going in here.
Come on, open up."
"Everyone's looking at us, Sarge," said Nobby.
Doors and windows had opened all along the street.
"And don't call me Sarge when we're in plain clothes." "Right you are, Fred. That's..."
Colon hesitated in an agony of status.
"Well, that's Frederick to you, Nobby. And they're giggling, Fred. Frederick. We don't want to make a cock-up of this, Nobby." "Right, Frederick. And that's Cecil, thank you."
"Cecil?"
"That is my name," said Nobby coldly. Have it your way, said Colin. Just remember who's the superior civilian around here, all right.
He hammered on the door again.
We hear you've got a room to let, missus, he yelled.
Brilliant, Frederick, said Nobby. That was bloody brilliant. Well, I am the sergeant, right,
Colin whispered.
No, yeah, right. Well, you just remember that, right?
The door snapped open. The woman within had one of those faces that had settled over the years, as though it had been made of butter and then left in the sun. But age hadn't been able to do much with her hair. It was a violent ginger and piled up like a threatening thunderhead.
Room? You should have said, she said. $2 a week, no pets, no cooking, no women after 6 a.m. If you don't want it, thousands do. Are you with the circus? You look like you're with the circus.
Plain clothes was the problem. Both the men had been used to uniforms all their lives. Sergeant Colan's only suit had been bought by a man 2 stone lighter and 10 years younger, so the buttons creaked under tension. And Nobby's idea of plain clothes was the ribbon and bell-bedecked costume he wore as a leading member of the Ankh-Morpork Folk Dance and Song Society. Small children had followed them in the street to see where the show was going to be.
We're...
Colan began, and then stopped. There were undoubtedly a large number of things to be apart from policemen, but there and then, he couldn't think of any of them.
Actors, said Nobby. Then it's payment a week in advance, said the woman, and no filthy foreign habits. This is a respectable house, she added, in defiance of evidence so far. We ought to see the room first, said Colan. Oh, the choosy sort, eh?
She led them upstairs. The room vacated so terminally by Ossie was small and bare. A few items of clothing hung on nails in the wall, and a heap of wrappers and greasy bags indicated that Ossie had been a man who ate, as it were, off the street.
"Whose is this stuff?" said Sergeant Colon. "Oh, he's gone now. I told him he'd be out if he didn't pay up. I'll throw it all out afore you settle in."
"We'll get rid of it for you,"
said Sergeant Colon. He fumbled in his pouch and produced a couple of dollars.
"Here you are, Miss... Mrs. Spent,"
said Mrs. Spent. She gave them a lopsided look.
"Are you both stopping here, or what?"
"Nah, I've just come along as his chaperone," said Colan, giving her a friendly grin. "He has to fight women off when they find out about his sexual magnetism."
Mrs. Spent gave the shocked Nobby a sharp look and bustled out of the room.
"What you going to say that for?" said Nobby. "It's got rid of her, hasn't it? You were having a go at me, don't deny it, just because I'm going through a bit of emotional what's-name, eh?
It was just a joke, Nobby, just a joke."
Nobby peered under the narrow bed.
"Wow,"
he said, all emotional wassernames forgotten.
"What is it? What is it?"
said Colan.
"It looks like a complete run of bows and ammo. And,"
Nobby pulled another stack of badly engraved magazines out into the light,
"here's Warrior of Fortune, look, and Practical Siege Weapons."
Colan leafed through page after page of very similar-looking people holding very similar weapons of personal destruction.
"You've got to be a bit odd to sit around all day reading this kind of thing," he said.
"Yeah," said Nobby. "Here, don't put that one back. That's last August's issue. I ain't got that one. Hang on, there's a box right at the back."
He wriggled out, towing a small box with him. It was locked, but the cheap metal gave away when he accidentally levered at the lid. Silver coins gleamed. Lots and lots of them.
"Whoops," he muttered. "We're in trouble now." "That's Clatchian money, that is," said Colan. "Sometimes people slip you one instead of half a dollar in your change. Look, there's all curly writing on them." "We're in big trouble," said Nobby. "No, no, no. This is a clue, what we have found by patient detectoring," said Sergeant Colan. "And it's going to be a feather in our caps and no mistake when Mr. Vimes hears about it." "How much do you reckon there is?" "Got to be hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth," said Colan. "And that's a lot of money to a Clatchian. You can probably live like a king for a year and a dollar in Clatch."
"It wasn't very patient detecting," said Nobby doubtfully. "All I did was look under the bed."
"Ah, but that's because you is trained," said Colan. "Your basic civilian wouldn't think of that right." "It all begins to make sense."
"Does it?"
Why would the Clatchians give him money to shoot a Clatchian? Said Nobby.
Colon tapped the side of his nose.
Politics, he said. Oh, politics, said Nobby. Oh, well, politics, I see. Yeah. Politics, right. So, why? Aha,
said Colon again, tapping the other side of his nose.
Why are you picking your nose, Sarge? I'm tapping it, said Colon severely. That's to show I'm in the know.
In the nose, said Nobby cheerfully.
It's just the sort of underhand cunning thing they do, said Colon.
Paying us to kill them, said Nobby.
Ah, you see, some Clatchian knob gets topped here, and then they can send a snotty note saying, you killed our big knob, you foreign nephews of dogs. This means war. See? Perfect excuse.
Do you need an excuse to have a war? Said Nobby. I mean, who for? Can't you just say, you got lots of cash and land, but I've got a big sword, so divvy up right now, chop chop.
That's what I'd do, said Corporal Nobbs, military strategist.
And I wouldn't even say that until after I'd attacked.
Ah, but that's because you don't know about politics, said Colon. You can't do that stuff anymore. Mark my words, this case has got politics written all over it. That's why old Vimes put me on it, depend upon it. Politics. Young carrots all very well, but you need a experienced man of the world in these delicate political situations.
You've certainly got the nose tapping just right, said Nobby. I generally miss. But he felt troubled, if not in his nose, then in whatever small organ propelled his blood around his body. This didn't feel right. Nothing much in Nobby's life had ever felt right, so he knew very well how the feeling felt. He looked up at the bare walls and down at the rough floorboards.
There's a bit of sand on the floor, he said. Another clue, then, said Colon happily. A Clatchian has been here. Bugger all else but sand in Clatch. Still got some in his sandals.
Nobby opened the window. It gave on to a gently sloping roof. Someone could get through it easily and be away over the tiles and into the maze of chimneys.
He could have gone in and out this way, Sarge, he volunteered. Good point, Nobby. Write that down. Evidence of conniving and sneaking around.
Nobby peered down.
Yeah, there's glass outside, Fred.
Sergeant Colon joined him at the stricken window. One of the panes had been smashed. Outside, glass glittered on the tiles.
That could be a clue, eh? Said Nobby, hopefully. It certainly is, said Sergeant Colon. See, the glass fell outside the window. Everyone knows you look at which way the glass falls. I reckon he was just testing his bow, and it went off while he was loaded. That's clever, Sarge, said Nobby. That's detectoring, said Colon. It's no good just looking at things, Nobby. You gotta think straight, too.
Cecil, Sarge.
That's Frederick, Cecil. Come on, I think we've wrapped this up nicely. Old Vimes says he wants a report toot sweet.
Nobby looked out of the broken window. The roof abutted the end wall of a much larger warehouse. For a moment he found himself thinking bendy rather than straight, but he reasoned that his thinking was only a corporal's thinking and worth far less per thought than a sergeant's thinking, so he kept his private thoughts to himself. As they went downstairs, Mrs. Spent watched them suspiciously through a barely opened doorway at the far end of the hall, clearly ready to slam it shut at the first suggestion of any sexual magnetism.
It's not as if I even know where to get a sexual magnet, Nobby muttered. And she didn't even laugh.
Also, we went to the bow shops in the Street of Cunning Artificers and showed the iconograph to the man in Burly and Strong in the Arm who vouchsafed that is him, e.g. he was referring to the diseased. Oh, my. Vimes' lips moved slightly as his gaze went back up the page. Also, in addition to the Clatchian money, you could tell one of them had been there because of, e.g., the sand on the floor. He'd still got sand in his sandals, murmured Vimes. Good grief.
Sam?
Vimes looked up from his reading.
Your soup will be cold, said Lady Sybil from the far end of the table. You've been holding that spoonful in the air for the last 5 minutes by the clock.
Sorry, dear.
What are you reading?
Oh, just a little masterpiece,
said Vimes, pushing Fred Colon's report aside. "Interesting, is it?" said Lady Sybil, a little sourly. "Practically unparalleled," said Vimes. "The only things they haven't found are the bunch of dates and the camel hidden under the pillow." Belatedly, his nuptial radar detected a certain chilliness from the far side of the cruet. "Is there something wrong, dear?" he said. "Can you remember when we last had dinner together, Sam?" "Tuesday, wasn't it?" "That was the Guild of Merchants' annual dinner, Sam." Vimes's brow wrinkled. "But you were there too, weren't you?" A further subtle change in the Dragon House quotient told him that this was not a well-chosen answer. "And then you rushed off afterwards because of that business with the barber in Gleam Street." "Sweeney Jones," said Vimes. "Well, he was killing people, Sybil. The best you could say is that he didn't mean to. He was just very bad at shaving." "But you didn't have to go, I'm sure." "Policing's a 24-hour job, dear." "Only for you. Your constables do their 10 hours and that's it. But you're always working. It's not good for you. You're always running around during the day. And when I wake up in the middle of the night, there's always a cold space beside me." The dots hung in the air, the ghosts of words unsaid. Little things, thought Vimes. That's how a war starts. "There's so much to do, Sybil," he said as patiently as he could. "There's always been a lot to do, and the bigger the watch gets, the more there is to do. Have you noticed that?" Vimes nodded. That was true. Rotas, receipts, notebooks, reports. The watch might or might not be making a difference in the city, but it was certainly frightening a lot of trees. "You ought to delegate," said Lady Sybil. "So he tells me," muttered Vimes. "Pardon?" "Just thinking aloud, dear." Vimes pushed the paperwork away. "I'll tell you what. Let's have an evening in," he said. "There's a nice fire in the drawing room." No, Sam, there isn't." "Hasn't young Forthright lit it?" Forthright was the boy. It came as news to Vimes that this was an official servant position, but the boy's job was to light the fires, clean the privies, help the gardener, and take the blame. "He's gone off to be a drummer boy in the Duke of Aol's regiment," said Lady Sybil. "Him too. He seemed a bright lad." "Isn't he too young?" "He said he was going to lie about his age." "I hope he lies about his musical ability. I've heard him whistling." Vimes shook his head. "Whatever possessed him to do such a daft thing?" "He thinks the uniform will impress the girls." Sybil gave him a gentle smile. An evening at home suddenly began to seem very inviting. "Well, it won't take a genius to find the woodshed," said Vimes, "and then we can bolt the doors and..." One of the aforesaid doors shook to the sound of frantic knocking. Vimes caught Sybil's gaze. "Go on, then, answer it," she sighed and sat down. The door admitted Corporal Littlebottom, seriously out of breath.
"You got to come quick, sir. It's murder this time."
Vimes looked helplessly at his wife.
"Of course you must go," she said.
Angua brushed out her hair in front of the mirror.
"I don't like this," said Carrot. "It's not a proper way to behave."
She patted him on the shoulder.
"Don't worry," she said. "Vimes explained it all. You're acting as though we're doing something wrong."
"I like being a watchman," said Carrot, still in the mournful depths. "And you've got to wear a uniform. If you don't wear a uniform, it's like spying on people. He knows I think that."
Angua looked at his short red hair and honest ears.
"I've taken a lot of the work off his shoulders," Carrot went on. "He doesn't have to go on patrol at all, but he still tries to do everything."
"Perhaps he doesn't want you to be quite so helpful,"
said Angua, as tactfully as possible.
"It's not as if he's getting any younger, either. I've tried to point that out."
"That was kind of you.
And I've never worn plain clothes."
"On you, they'll never be very plain," said Angua, pulling on her coat. It was a relief to be out of that armour. As for Carrot, there was no disguising him. The size, the ears, the red hair, the expression of muscular good-naturedness.
"I suppose a werewolf is in plain clothes all the time when you think about it," said Carrot.
"Thank you, Carrot, and you're absolutely right. I just don't feel comfortable living a lie."
"Walk a mile on these paws."
"Pardon?"
"Oh, nothing." Gorif's son, Janil, had been angry. He didn't know why. The anger was built up of a lot of things. The firebomb last night was a big part. So were some of the words he'd been hearing in the street. He'd had an argument with his father about sending that food round to the watch house this morning. They were an official part of the city. They had those stupid badges. They had uniforms. He was angry about a lot of things, including the fact that he was 13. So when at 9 in the evening, while his father was baking bread, the door had slammed back and a man had rushed in, Janil had pulled his father's elderly crossbow from under the counter and aimed it where he thought the heart was and pulled the trigger. Carrot stamped his feet once or twice and looked around. "Here," he said. "I was standing here, and the prince was in that direction." Angua obediently walked across the square. Several people turned to look curiously at Carrot. "All right, stop. No, on a bit. Stop. Turn a little bit to the left. I mean, my left. Back a bit. Now, throw your arms up." He walked over to her and followed her gaze. "He was shot from the university." "Looks like the library building," said Angua. "But a wizard wouldn't do it, surely. They keep out of that sort of thing." "Oh, it's not too hard to get in there, even when the gates are shut," said Carrot. "Let's try the unofficial way, shall we?" "Okay." "Carrot?"
"Yes?"
"The, false moustache. It's not you, you know, and the nose is far too pink. Doesn't it make me look inconspicuous?"
"No.
And the hat. I should lose the hat, too. It's a good hat," she added quickly, "but a brown bowler is not your style. It doesn't suit you."
"Exactly," said Carrot. "If it was my style, people would know it's me, right?"
"I mean, it makes you look like a twerp, Carrot."
"Do I normally look like a twerp?"
"No, not..."
"Aha!"
Carrot fumbled in the pocket of his large brown overcoat. "I got this book of disguises from the joke shop in Phaedra Road, look. Funny thing, Nobby was in there buying stuff too. I asked him why, and he said it was desperate measures. What do you think he meant by that?"
"I can't imagine," said Angua.
"It's just amazing the stuff they've got. False hair, false noses, false beards, even false..." He hesitated and began to blush. "Even false, you know, chests. For ladies. But I can't imagine for the life of me why they'd want to disguise those." He probably couldn't, Angua thought. She took the very small book from Carrot and glanced through it. She sighed. "Carrot, these disguises are meant for a potato."
"Are they?"
"Look, they're all on potatoes, see?"
"I thought that was just for display."
"Carrot, it's got Mr. Spuddy Face on it." Behind his thick black moustache, Carrot looked hurt and perplexed.
"What does a potato want a disguise for?" he said.
They'd reached the alley alongside the university that had been known informally as Scholar's Entry for so many centuries that this was now on a nameplate at one end. A couple of student wizards went past. The unofficial entrance to the university has always been known only to students. What most students failed to remember was that the senior members of the faculty had also been students once, and also liked to get out and about after the official shutting of the gates. This naturally led to a certain amount of embarrassment and diplomacy on dark evenings. Carrot and Angua waited patiently as a few more students climbed over, followed by the dean.
"Good evening, sir," said Carrot politely.
"Good evening to you, Spuddy," said the dean, and ambled off into the night.
"You see?"
"Ah, but he didn't call me Carrot," said Carrot. "The principal is sound."
They dropped down onto the lawns of academia and headed for the library.
"It'll be shut," said Angua.
"Remember, we have a man on the inside," said Carrot, and knocked. The door opened a little way.
"Ooh!"
Carrot raised his horrible little round hat.
"Good evening, sir. I wonder if we could come in. It's watch business."
"Ooh! Ooh! 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 Ooh!"
"What did he say?" said Angua.
"If you must know, he said, 'My goodness me, a walking potato,'" said Carrot.
The librarian wrinkled his nose at Angua. He did not like the smell of werewolves. But he beckoned them inside and then left them waiting while he knuckled back to his desk and rummaged in a drawer. He produced a watch special constable's badge on a string, which he hung around the general area where his neck should have been, and then stood as much to attention as an orangutan can, which is not a great deal. The central ape gets the idea, but outlying areas are slow to catch on.
"Ooh, ooh, ooh."
"Was that
"How may I be of assistance, Captain Tuber?" said Angua. "We need to have a look on the fifth floor overlooking the square," said Carrot, a shade coldly.
"Ook, ook, ook."
"He says that's just old storerooms," said Carrot. "And that last ook?" said Angua. "Mr. Horrible Hat," said Carrot. "Still, he hasn't worked out who you are, eh?" said Angua. The fifth floor was a corridor of airless rooms, smelling sadly of old unwanted books. They were stacked not on shelves, but on wide racks, bundled up with string. A lot of them were battered and missing their covers. Judging by what remained, though, they were old textbooks that not even the most ardent bibliophile could treasure. Carrot picked up a torn copy of Waddley's Occult Primer. Several loose pages fell out. Angua picked one up. "Chapter 15, Elementary Necromancy," she read aloud. "Lesson 1, Correct Use of Shovel." She put it down again and sniffed the air. The presence of the librarian filled the nasal room like an elephant in a matchbox, but... "Someone else has been in here," she said, "in the last couple of days. Could you leave us, sir? When it comes to odours, you're a bit, forthright."
"Ooh?"
The librarian nodded at Carrot, shrugged at Angua, and ambled out.
"Don't move," said Angua. "Stay right where you are, Carrot. Don't disturb the air."
She inched forward carefully. Her ears told her the librarian was down the corridor because she could hear the floorboards creaking, but her nose told her that he was still here. He was a little fuzzy, but...
"I'm going to have to change," she said. "I can't get a proper picture this way. It's too strange."
Carrot obediently shut his eyes. She'd forbidden him to watch her en route from a human to a wolf because of the unpleasant nature of the shapes in between. Back in Überwald, people went from one shape to the other as naturally as ordinary humans would put on a different coat, but even there it was considered polite to do it behind a bush. When he reopened them, Angua was slinking forward, her whole being concentrated in her nose. The olfactory presence of the librarian was a complex shape, a mere purple blur where he had been moving, but almost a solid figure where he'd been standing still. Hands, face, lips. They'd be just the centre of an expanding cloud in a few hours' time, but now she could still smell them out. There must be only the tiniest air currents in here. There weren't even any flies buzzing in the dead air to cause a ripple of disturbance. She edged nearer to the window. Vision was a mere shadowy presence, providing a charcoal sketch of a room over which the scents painted their glorious colours. By the window. By the window, yes. A man had stood there, and by the scent of it, he hadn't moved for some time. The smell wavered in the air on the edge of her nasal skill. The curling, billowing traces said that the window had been opened and closed again, and was there just the merest, tiniest suggestion that he'd held an arm out in front of him? Her nose raced, trying to form original shapes from the patterns hanging in the room like dead smoke. When she'd finished, Angua went back to her pile of clothes and coughed politely while she was pulling on her boots. "There was a man standing by the window," she said. "Long hair, a bit dry, stinks of expensive shampoo. He was the man who nailed the boards back after Rossi got into the barbican."
"Are you sure? Is this nose ever wrong?"
"Sorry. Go on. I'd say he was heavy set, a bit bulky for his height. He doesn't wash a lot, but when he does, he uses Windpike soap, the cheap brand, but expensive shampoo, which is odd, quite new boots and a green coat."
"You can smell the colour?"
"No, the dye. It comes from Stolat, I think, and I think he shot a bow. An expensive bow. There's a hint of silk in the air, and that's what the strongest bowstrings are made of, isn't it? And you wouldn't put one of those on a cheap bow." Carrot stood by the window. "He got a good view," he said, and looked down at the floor, and then at the sill, and on the shelves nearby.
"How long was he here?"
2 or 3 hours, I'd say. "He didn't move around much?"
"No.
Or smoke? Or spit? He just stood and waited. A professional."
"Mr. Vimes was right."
"A lot more professional than Ozzy," said Angua.
"Green coat," said Carrot, as if thinking aloud. "Green coat. Green coat.
Oh, and bad dandruff," said Angua, standing up.
"Snowy slopes?"
shouted Carrot.
"What? Really bad dandruff?"
"Oh, yes, it was.
That's why they called him Snowy, said Carrot. Daceyville Slope's the man with the reinforced comb. But I'd heard he'd moved to Stowlat. In unison, they said, where the dye comes from.
Is he good with a bow? Said Angua.
Very good. He's good at killing people he never met, too. He's an assassin, is he? Oh, no, he just kills people for money. No style. Snowy can't read and write.
Carrot scratched his head in sympathetic recollection. He doesn't even look at complicated pictures. We'd have got him last year, but he shook his head fast and got away while we were trying to dig out Nobby.
Well, well, I wonder where he's staying.
Don't ask me to follow him in these streets. Thousands of people will have walked over the trail.
Oh, there's people who will know. Someone sees everything in this town.